aggressions. Do you know what I'm talking about? Those subtle jabs that chip away at our sense of self-worth. On today's show, Dr. Brian Mustansky, assistant professor for the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Illinois at Chicago, talks with us about micro-assaults, micro-insults, and micro-invalidations. All these little bits of hate spewed by others can add up to a mountain of despair or depression if you don't deal with them.
Listen as Brian shares with us some steps you can take to heal and protect yourself from these attacks and how to speak openly and honestly with those around you.
Brian's also taking questions from you through Facebook about your mental health issues.
The African country of Malawi says no to Madonna's attempt at adopting an orphan girl.
A German woman divorces her husband for cleaning too much.
Lady Gaga goes goo-goo over a fan's hoo-ha.
The Japanese pop star Hideki Kaji was robbed of his camera equipment while dressed as a pineapple.
And congratulations to Iowa for legalizing same-sex marriage. Will the meth state be renamed the marriage state?
Listen up, people. This show just might save your life. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Today's show is brought to you by you. You, the fabulous listener, and your support make it all possible.
If you like our programming, go to our website, feastoffun.com, and make a financial contribution. Or get yourself a fabulous t-shirt. Thank you for your support. What are those subtle jabs, those subtle little attacks that chip away at our sense of self-worth? On today's show, we're talking to Dr. Brian Mustansky. He's the assistant professor for the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and he's a blogger for Psychology Today. What is a microassault, Brian?
Well, this concept of microassault really came out of research on ethnic minority people, really looking at, I mean, if you think of, people used to think of racism as being really overt, using racial slurs or laws that might be passed that would prevent ethnic minority people from having the same rights as Caucasian people.
Jim Crow's law, so preventing people from sharing the same
poll taxes, things like that.
Exactly. The same drinking fountain.
Right, but now as we've been studying minority psychology, we're really realizing that a lot of these experiences that minority people have are more subtle and can take the form of things like a African-American person being followed around a store and wondering, you know, is that person following me? Is the shopkeeper following me because of the color of my skin? Or am I just being paranoid? And we consider that a micro, what this researcher at Columbia calls microaggressions. Microaggressions, right. The idea being that it's really this double-edged sword, this sort of double whammy of the insult of having this person follow you around, but also the internal conflict you experience, questioning yourself. Should I point this out? Should I call out the shopkeeper for following me around? And if you don't, you might kind of feel bad because you think, why didn't I stick up for myself?
So you're being accused of being too sensitive.
And if you do call him out, you might get accused of being too sensitive and then feel bad about that.
But so it's the quandary of like, do I confront this? Do I not confront this? Do I ignore it? Do I make a big deal out of it? You know, where do I take it? How do I do it?
Exactly.
So is it the confusion over it that can drive us nuts?
It's both. It's both the experience and then that sort of questioning yourself. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and so people have been studying this in terms of ethnic minorities, and I've become really interested in how LGBT people experience these sorts of microaggressions. What are the experiences that we have in our everyday life that sort of wear us down as well?
So like my mom asking me, you know, when are you going to marry a nice girl? Although my mother's actually never asked me that. But, you know, there's some people who are like, well, if you weren't gay or if you weren't in that relationship, you know, subtle things.
Absolutely.
Like people rubbing their heterosexuality
or
in
even
your
just
face.
Like, you know, school kids at school all day and they hear like, oh, that's so gay. That's so gay.
Exactly.
That's is that a micro assault? It's a micro.
Right. So he sort of categorized things in sort of micro assaults, which are more like name calling, mm-hmm. maybe calling somebody a fag, using those kind of words. Mm-hmm. Micro insults, which are more sort of comments about a person's heritage that sort of have a more hidden insulting message. And then micro invalidations are sort of things that invalidate who you are as a person. So if you, for example, was talking to your friend and said, you know, this person, you know, I felt like they weren't treating me well because I was gay. People were staring at me or whatever with my boyfriend. you might have a friend, a heterosexual friend, who might say, you're just being too...
It's all in your head.
It's all in your head, exactly. You're being too sensitive. And that's invalidating because mm-hmm. it sort of tells you, you know, your experiences aren't true. It makes you question yourself even more. So they sort of have this typology of these three different types of microaggressions in these different groups. And so, right, we've been really curious as mm-hmm. to how LGBT people experience that, whether it's overhearing someone say, that's so gay, whether it's people asking you about when you're going to get married. You know, as I was thinking about it, I was like walking up to a customs agent with my partner, and we walked up and put our passports on the table, and he looked at us and kind of gave us a funny look and was like, you guys friends? You know, and it was clear the question was like, why did these two guys walk up together? It should be couples.
But like married couples do that all the time.
Exactly.
Don't they?
And so I'm thinking, should I say something? Should I be like, why are you questioning us? We're a same-sex couple. We have the right to walk up and show you our passports at the same time.
Well, maybe that's why I feel more comfortable in challenging people's sort of prejudice or ignorance on my homosexuality, is because I come from a different culture. And so I've already felt like an outsider living in the United States, being a Puerto Rican. And so that informs my gay experience. Mm-hmm. So I'm very comfortable in telling somebody's like they're racist or being sexist, or you're not necessarily labeling that, but just saying, mm-hmm. you know, you're don't be stupid. You know, it's like, yeah. I'm gay. Okay. You know, it's like, it's sort of like in sometimes as gay and lesbian people, we're really good at finding humor in these painful experiences, but also we're really good at embracing negative experiences and building upon them as sources of strength.
Mm-hmm.
But at a certain point, I find that our desire to embrace words like queer or fag or you know, other words that are used against us or concepts that are used against us actually in the long term hold us back. And what we're really wanting to do is to be embraced by society at large.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're using those words as micro insult, because they might not walk up to you to your face and say, you know, you're just a big fag. Well, some people do, but like they'll say, oh, that's gay, or don't be so faggy, that kind of
thing. Or even not even as overt, just saying, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, well, a real man wouldn't right. cry.
Yeah.
Wouldn't mind that their car got smashed.
But what does that do to us psychologically? I mean, is it what's happening to us because of this? What's the consequence of an assault,
yeah,
or
whether it be large or small?
Yeah, well, it hasn't really been that well studied at all amongst gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender people.
Mm-hmm.
There's been some research in Asian Americans and African Americans and Latinos suggesting that, you know, the accumulation of these sorts of experiences can be related to depression, substance use, sort of ways of, you know, people using substances perhaps to cope with sort of dealing with these everyday negative experiences. But we're in the process of developing a questionnaire to measure this in LGBT people, and we're very interested in seeing how it relates to things like mental health. But can be the protective things against these?
Would you be surprised if your results were any different than most other minorities?
Yeah, I'd be surprised.
So you're assuming it's probably going to be
yes.
very similar.
But what I think we're interested in doing is trying to figure out what are the things that are protective as well. So mm-hmm. it's probably not going to be a surprise that when we study this, it'll correlate with depression or something like that. But like, what are the things that those people who check off, you know, that they've mm-hmm. experienced these things but are doing well? What are the things about them that we can learn?
Well, what do you say to people that think like, oh, these are just, they're minor things, just brush them off, move forward, you know, it's not a big deal. You're making a big deal out of really nothing.
Well, I think Fausto actually gave a really good example of sometimes people don't understand this, and if you can put it in a context that they understand, so if they're a minority in some other way, mm-hmm. you can talk about, well, as a Puerto Rican person and living in the United States, have you ever experienced, you know, things that you felt were insulting or kind of put you down because of your heritage, and that maybe weren't so, maybe were subtle.
Well, and this is something I always explain, because when I ever tell somebody, I'm not a person who grew up in Humboldt Park and my great grandmother was from Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. I was born and raised there. I, for the first 7 years of my life, I spoke only Spanish. And therefore, I say words a little bit strangely. Funny.
That's cute.
And you know, coming and discovering and being and coming to terms with my attraction to men as a Puerto Rican man, and dealing with the sexism and homophobia and machismo, as you can say, in Puerto Rico, gave me a very different take on what it means to be gay in the United States, then I would say for most people, whatever ethnicity and background you have. And one thing that whenever I bring up the fact that I'm Puerto Rican to any American, some of these ignorant folks, they always say, I don't know why Puerto Rico just doesn't become a state. Which is very similar to the discussion of why don't gay people want to assimilate or become part of heterosexual society. And I said, because there's something valuable in being same but different.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather's cousin was one of the men who drafted what the Commonwealth status was. So it's a big source of family pride, the political status of Puerto Rico. And for me as a gay man, it's a very source of importance, what it means to be embraced, understood, and enthusiastically appreciated by everyone, but at the same time keeping your identity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the value of being Puerto Rican is that we can learn from different disenfranchised groups and understand how to make the world a better place for everyone. That said, doesn't this make us a little bit more self-conscious about when we throw shade and insults at each other and play around with each other? You know, it's like, girl, you look a little bit, sissy tonight, you know?
Well, I think part of it is whether it's something coming from somebody who's in your community or not. I mean, I think people who are gay maybe can get away with saying something to another gay man that, like, a heterosexual person maybe should think through a little bit more carefully before
they say.
Well, but,
you know, sometimes, like I've seen people, and even my mm-hmm. own partner, he's, like, says things that really, like, break my heart apart, you know?
I do?
Yes.
Aww.
I'm not going to bring that up here, but I'm saying that sometimes, like, we say things to the people we love that are very close to us. And,
well, they always hurt you the most.
And they hurt us the most. And, you know, they don't necessarily mean to attack you at your core, but the consequences are that. So how can we better communicate with each other so we're not feeling self-conscious about expressing ourselves, but at the same time we're able to say, you know, that sort of playful dig that you said the other day really, really hurt my feelings. How do we say those things?
How do we, as people who might be victimized, express that?
Yeah, communicate that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the complexity is right. You don't want to. Everyone doesn't want to become debilitated and can't feel like they can't say anything because they're so monitoring mm-hmm. everything they say that they don't want to be a microaggressive against one population or the other and just walk around with tape over their mouth because they don't want to say anything.
And some people do feel that way. You know, that's where the whole term political correctness came. Is that people in the early 90s and late 80s felt so self-conscious about transgressions against a disenfranchised group that they felt like they couldn't really speak honestly.
Well, I also think it was, I mean, I think some of it is like people with a lot of power in the majority, like being sick of having to worry about people threatening their power. And so then they just bring, oh, it's political correctness. Why are these people always, you know, complaining? I just want to brush that aside and invalidate that concern.
Who developed the term political correctness? Wasn't that like Karl Rove?
It was like Rush Limbaugh or something.
It was a term that was embraced mm-hmm. by a lot of people, even right. though its sources are probably with, you know, religious conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, like when someone like Whoopi Goldberg says, I'm a victim of political correctness and I can't speak honestly because someone is going to accuse me of being a bigot,
mm-hmm.
then I think, you know, especially she's an actual Jewish African-American
woman.
She claims to be.
Really?
Yeah, she got into trouble because they asked her, what's her favorite recipe? And then she's like, oh, I love, this is my recipe for Jewish American princess chicken. You call Kentucky Fried Chicken and you order out. And she got into so much trouble for saying that. And she said, well, I am... I identify as Jewish.
I think it's probably because of that, because it's an old joke. What does a Jewish woman make for dinner? Reservations.
Yeah, that's pretty much what that joke is. And,
right.
and you know, you may not think it's funny or whatever. You know,
well, because they're not known for good cuisine.
Is our bad jokes or our shady jokes like this, you know, are they microaggressions? What?
Well, I think sometimes when it's within the community, it's actually a way of sort of coping and like turning, like you said before, turning things into humor, turning oppression into humor. And like, when we mimic like heterosexual people and the things they might say to denigrate our community, it's sort of a way of like humorizing it and sort of coping with some of the oppression. So I think that can be healthy. It can be a healthy way to like cope with some of those experiences. You know, I mean, I think it's also about the difference between like insulting somebody's identity versus like insulting the person. Like you may have a bone to pick with Mark about something he did or vice versa, but that's like about Mark. It's not about him as a gay man or, you know, I think that's part of the difference as well. Like you're welcome to like,
because what you're saying is a lot of these things to it, it's kind of like as though it's like a mini hate crime.
Yeah.
And so people...
A mini, but that's kind of cute.
Because you're just saying, well, you know, hateful things hate just because of who you are as a person and not...
So what is the consequence? How do we take steps to heal from these microaggressions and protect ourselves in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about finding ways to cope with these experiences. And so some people may do that by turning to humor. Some people may get mobilized and want to fight, you know, these kinds of oppression, whether it be, you know, working with LGBT organizations that are working for legalizing same-sex rights, or whether providing services to people in the LGBT community, and they sort of take that oppression and turn it into action. That can be a very healthy way to deal with these things. You know, sometimes, unfortunately, people turn to negative ways of coping, like using drugs or feeling depressed, and I think...
Or, you know, or during the sort of cyberbullying, sort of like picking on people that they feel that they could gain from... attacking them on either as a person in their school or somebody they know or somebody that they want to attack.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the Swedish pastor. I was reading this news article and this Swedish pastor got drunk and went onto a website and started a dating website and started insulting the women on there, telling them they'd have to pay for sex or you look like a bearded lady for real.
Really?
Yeah, he said, or you look really drab and dreary. So he was thinking that they should find their love someplace else.
Well, sometimes I feel like a lot of these sort of religious leaders or community leaders would do themselves a great service by training themselves in therapy and counseling. You know, because like it seems like they're almost like in this job because they don't know what else. They're like frustrated bloggers looking for an audience. And I've gone to like I've humored some of my friends and gone to their church services. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there. I'm like, this is just a bad blog. You know,
it's funny you should mention that because I was kind of thinking it was like I felt like I was reading the Huffington Post and they had Obama and he's in Turkey and he's telling, you know, the Turkish people like, you know, America is not a Christian nation. It's not a Muslim nation. It's not a Jewish nation. It's a nation of citizens. And I was just like, thank God somebody's finally saying something like that. I felt like that. It was healing.
But you know, the problem I have with that, the people are reporting on Obama making that quote is they're just drooling at it.
We are a Christian nation.
And he's saying, they're taking him out of context, right? Mm-hmm. And so instead of saying, we're not these religions, we are a nation of values and citizens, they're already saying, Obama said, we are not a Christian nation. Yeah. That's the quote, you know?
Right.
And I'm like, fuck you, pundits.
I'm happy to hear that quote, you know? I really am.
But they're trying to, you know,
but there's certain people who aren't happy to hear that. Yeah. And
it's confusing the message.
That's who they're speaking to when they say it, yeah.
So Dr. Brian Mustansky, who writes a lot about the romantic lives of gay men and lesbians and transgendered and bisexual people, and how you can take steps to heal and embrace who you are. He's taking your questions through Facebook, through the Feast of Fools Facebook page, or through my profile page, Fausto Furnos. Here's a question from Anthony Briani. He says, is there a higher prevalence of mental illness among members of the gay community or disenfranchised groups?
There is some evidence that LGBT people do have higher levels of depression, some forms of substance use. Not necessarily alcohol per se, but maybe like what we think of as club drugs, like ecstasy,
club drugs.
Methamphetamine, things like that.
What's a club
drug? GHB.
Things you do at a club, at a dance
recreational
club. Recreational drugs, GHB.
As opposed to drugs for work?
What do you mean by like term something like a downer, like something that's going to put you out, like that's
something to take to stay at home and disconnect.
Yeah, right.
It's about connecting with other people by being toxic.
Yeah, primarily like uppers and drugs that lead to disinhibition, those kinds of things. So there is some evidence of that, and both primarily in adults, we know less about young people. You know, there's been some interesting questions as to why that is. You know, I think people are very sensitive about this question because it used to be that being gay was considered a mental illness in its own right. And part of the evidence that people would use to support the idea that it was a mental illness was pointing to high levels of depression and other stress-related anxiety disorders. And so, you know, as researchers in this area, we have to be very careful to point out that because you're gay does not mean that you will have depression or you will have an anxiety disorder. Being a part of a community that has some stigma associated with it, you know, is stressful and can lead to anxiety disorders and depression and substance use.
But why are there so many crazy, crazy queers out there?
There's a lot of crazy everybody out there.
But you know what I'm saying? It's like you hear people complaining about, it's usually, I've always said this, like some of the biggest perpetrators of abuse and violence to our own community is ourselves. And why is it that way? Is it that way with all disenfranchised groups?
I think you could probably make that argument. I mean, I don't think that our community necessarily struggles with that issue more than other disenfranchised groups.
Well, I think it's you're going to be hurt by the people that you know, and you're going to be attacked by people that know you personally.
Because nobody in Japan is thinking about my video blog and caring about, you know what I'm saying? It's like they got their own next door neighbor.
In Japan.
But I'm saying like somebody, I'm more likely to be attacked by somebody I know. You know, they say rape happens with the people you know much more frequently than with strangers. And I think most attacks or abuses happen with those that we know because that's who we interact with.
Absolutely. So like
micro assaults, probably the ones that hurt you the most are things like that your parents are going to say to you, or right. your siblings or coworkers and things
Absolutely.
Like that. And people, like, if somebody, you know, if you're walking down the street and somebody screams faggot out of a car to you, you know, how much does that really affect you as opposed to, you know, your parents going, well, I don't see why you should get gay married.
Well, and that's why I take it much more personally, I think, is when, you know, because we're publicly, we're out there, and when somebody writes a blog entry about how they disagreed or they don't like us as people because of something that they heard on the show, it doesn't really hurt me as much as it is somebody that I personally know who is who has a grudge to bear and is taking that out on a very public way, trying to abuse and hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I think that it hurts you because they know who you are. They've had experience in you. When a stranger attacks you, it's like, well, so what if you called me fat and ugly? You know?
I think there's different people react to those things differently. Like, I think there are some people who, if somebody drives by and yells fag out the window, it really is going to bother them. I think some of us might be a little more
resilient. Fear.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even if you're not afraid the person's going to hurt you, just having that insult could be, you know, hurtful to some mm-hmm. people more than others. I think some people are really resilient against that and they're just, oh, that guy's an idiot. I don't care. But there's other people who might really find that to be upsetting.
So Christopher Benitez, when he came out to being gay as a gay man in 1997, his father took him to a psychiatrist. Obviously, it was because I came out. In talking with the psychiatrist about my sexuality, he suggested that I try dating a woman.
In 1997,
that's about
12
years ago. Is this or was this a common thing for a psychiatrist to tell a homosexual teenager? How is the psychiatrist community progressing in accepting homosexuality?
Well, I think one thing that you can say is that every major mental health organization, you know, the American Psychological Association, Psychiatric Association, et cetera, you know, has put out policy statements saying it is not good practice to try and change someone's sexual orientation. It can't be done and you shouldn't do it. It's probably going to be harmful. So
is there any penalty for trying?
Well, that's a good question because there probably is not necessarily. Mm-hmm. I mean,
you mean penalty for suggesting
like losing
that
your license clients. Or something? No, you probably wouldn't necessarily lose your license.
Should there be a penalty for it?
I mean, in my opinion, it wouldn't be a bad idea. My thinking was that those kinds of things are happening less and less, you know, as being gay has become more accepted, as these organizations have come out saying you shouldn't, as a professional, it would be malpractice or bad practice for you to try and change somebody's sexual orientation. But just a couple of weeks ago, I think it was in the last week or two, this study came out on a survey of psychiatrists in the UK
mm-hmm.
And found that about 30% of them had recently done something to try and change someone's sexual orientation, which I found shocking.
I think we reported on that.
Did you?
Yeah, we did report on that. I think it was like 17% at some point in time did do it sometime in their career,
uh-huh.
but only 6%.
Oh, was it that low?
Would actually ever consider doing it now? Because they just, you know, most people, I think, you know, when they're younger or something, because you know, some of these people have been practicing for probably 40, 50 years.
Yeah.
you know?
So can people sue their therapists for malpractice?
Well, you can sue anybody for anything anytime you want.
But I mean, you're in the field.
Yeah. I mean,
have you ever heard of anything like that where people have tried to do gay reparative therapy and just like,
And then made them, you know, sicker or could try to commit suicide when they came out of that darkness and they turned around and sued the therapist?
Because it's not classified as a mental disorder anymore.
Right. Right. I have heard of patients and seeing colleagues of mine who talked about a lot of negative results of going to see therapists that, you know, were trying to change their sexual orientation. I haven't heard of anyone suing. Maybe it's not a bad idea.
Should we put that idea out there, you know? You better watch out. If you don't got your, you know, ducks in a row when you're talking, it's, you know, it's like a lot of these religious leaders, they're just not prepared to talk about it. And instead of saying, this is my opinion, they're passing things off as facts. And that's what, you know, like on this show, I hope that nobody ever takes anything that we say as a fact, and except for the fact that we're reporting on it. We're just saying, this is what I read. This is what I've learned. Mm-hmm. And right. I want you, the listener, to make your own decisions and not take anything we ever say as the word of God or the word of science.
You have to have healthy skepticism with anything you hear.
But people don't.
But I usually try and put out there things that I think is real.
And, you know, when I see patients, I always am very clear to them about what's my opinion versus what is, you know, based on research. This is a recommendation based on research evidence that this will be the best way for us to help treat your depression versus, you know, some opinion I might have on something else.
You know
else.
What I tell them, Brian? I when people come up to me with these kind of things, I say, I try not to give bad advice. That's all I gotta say. But, you know, I can make mistakes too. Bruno Tanaka, my relationship with a girl ended when I tried to do reparative therapy. She hated me and I lost a best friend. Is what he wanted to say. A lot of people are weighing in on the fact that they tried dating girls as a way of healing themselves. Hmm. But what happens when you are in love with a gay man? Ryan Alvarez wants to know, what is the best way to deal with keeping that relationship healthy and jealousy issues?
Ooh.
Like, well, how do you open your heart so you're not possessive?
Ryan's Latino, so those jealousy issues are always going to be there.
That's why I don't date Latino men, you know, because they are like the first ones are going to be like, te mato. I'll kill you if I see you looking at another man.
They get so jealous. It's crazy.
But they're the first ones that are going to be playing the field.
Oh, no kidding. Believe me, I know. We've had our 10-year anniversary this past
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
But you know what I say? It's like the Latino men are the first ones. They have this double standard. And I'm, you know, characterizing my own people unfairly.
Is that a microaggression?
Well, maybe.
Maybe.
I mean, I could be wrong, but I I'm kind of like B'Elanna Torres in Voyager, who's half Klingon, half human. It's like I reject the sexism and double standards of my own community, but I embrace who I am. And who I am is of mixed cultures and mixed backgrounds. You know, how do we deal with jealousy in our relationships when sometimes jealousy can run bone deep and even culturally deep? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think one thing is to not pretend like it, or to pretend like it doesn't exist, that just deny that there could ever be any jealousy in your relationship. I think you have to be honest about it, that if you are in situations where you might feel jealous, you know, I think there's nothing wrong with, in a healthy way, telling your partner, like, wow, when we go to certain bars and you have too much to drink and I see you staring at people, that really makes me feel jealous. Now, you might not want to say that to the person when they're drunk in the bar.
No, I'm not!
But, you know, I think it can be, I mean, it's a good thing to communicate with. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think sometimes people are afraid to communicate that in a way that's healthy like that because it makes them feel vulnerable. You know, it makes you feel vulnerable to say to somebody, I feel jealous, I feel like you might want to leave me or something when you look at other guys like that. Mm-hmm. But I think it can be really liberating to express that. And then maybe you can find ways to, you know, in a healthy way.
So talk about it in a healthy way and probably not when you're drunk. That's what I find. It's like I try definitely not to argue with people when I've been drinking because it's just, first of all, they never hear you. They forget what you said. And then most of the time it's just pointless anyway.
Yeah. Well, when you're coming from that mental space, it's sort of like firing a weapon when you're drunk. Chances are you're going to miss where you're trying to shoot. And you're going to do more damage to yourself and to the people you love than you're actually going to do to protect yourself. A lot of people are losing their jobs and they're single and these times. Peter Vega and somebody else wrote here, Jacinto Ibarra, how do you deal with being jobless and single at the same time?
Sounds like, I mean, those are, I think, double stressors, right? Yeah, so you're lonely. I mean, I think people have to take their mental health seriously. And if you are stressed out by these experiences, whether it be joblessness or being single, you need to figure out what are the things that help keep you mentally healthy. Is it exercise? Is it going out and enjoying like a nice sunny day and like, you know, going to the beach or something like that? I mean, I think if you're under those kind of stressors, it's really important for you to take your mental health seriously and find those things that you can do that help you cope with those kinds of stress.
I got good advice. If you ain't got a job and you're lonely, go volunteer.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're going to kick yourself out of the house. You'll meet some hot new friends.
Mm-hmm. You'll keep yourself busy.
And that's really what's it about. It's just, you know, the Christians like to say the idle hands are the devil's workshop. Mm-hmm. It's like idle hands is the crazy workshop, too.
Because it'll drive you nuts if you don't have a hobby, if you're not doing things and stuff like that. But they also say, what is it? You can't. It used to be you never had a good boyfriend, a good job, and a good apartment at the same time. You're always missing one of them.
What does that come from?
I don't know. It's an old cliche they used to toss around.
So
you can't have everything in life, is what I'm saying.
Well, I say you can have everything. You should aim to have everything.
You should write a book. You can have everything.
Well, I've always thought you can have everything. I absolutely can have everything.
You know, I think that kind of statement is sort of like a microaggression against your own self-esteem. It's what Oprah likes to talk about: shadow beliefs that we don't deserve it all. That we don't deserve the same equality, the same kind of happiness that we see others having around us. Even other people that are from the same disenfranchised group.
Right.
You know, and we certainly get lots of messages and emails from people saying, you know, oh, woe is me. I feel sorry.
We get a lot of sadness.
Yeah. I think when you have all those things, it's a time to feel like really fortunate. You know, I mean, so I'm lucky that I do feel like I have a nice apartment. Mm-hmm. I've got a great partner and...
Fabulous.
Yeah, we have a nice place and, you know, I enjoy it. We just got our kitchen redone. You know, but I think probably a couple times a week, Jared and I will sit there on the couch and look at each other and be like, we are so lucky. You know, we really are. And we believe that. And so I think if you do have it all, you should, instead of waiting for the other shoe to drop, like look around you and realize how fortunate you really are.
And appreciate what you have.
And so how do you give back? I mean, if you got it all. I mean, besides, you know, you donate your time to come on this program and share with your insight. But is volunteering part of completing the circle? Is giving of yourself without asking for anything to return, either to other individuals or to your community, a vital part of your mental well-being?
I think so. I mean, I think I just couldn't imagine living my life without doing things like that. So I guess it's hard for me. And maybe it's who I surround myself with. There's a lot of people who do that kind of work. But...
because those kind of experiences kind of are actually going to bring you opportunities that actually do bring money and stability and a good apartment and a good boyfriend in the future. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have A, B, and C, apartment, boyfriend, job, give of your time, because those will open up those doors.
Well, you're building that safety net, that structure, that support. And you did something recently, too. You had an article about gay partnerships and your support network. What was that about? Same-sex couples.
Couples.
And you found that they have reported more positive relationship quality and less conflict than heterosexual married couples on nearly all the measures included in the study. Uh-huh. So why are gay people so gosh darn gay?
What? Say that again?
Why are gay people so gosh darn gay?
Why do we have better relationships?
You mean.
Yeah. And I think it's part of it is the communication. I think when you're in a same-sex relationship, there's not necessarily all these expectations for how you're going to live your relationship, how you're going to structure things. So you're forced to negotiate them and work them out and talk about them. And that's healthy. Like, you don't have these expectations that one partner is going to be the one who does the dishes and the laundry and cleans and the other one who's going to make the money, or one person's going to take care of the kids and do X, Y, Z. Every single one of those things becomes a discussion about how are we going to negotiate this in a way that works for both of us. And I think those kinds of discussions emerge more because there's not all those expectations about what our relationships are going to look like.
So now that Iowa has passed gay marriage,
can we give a?
Yeah, yay. Where's my tambourine? It's never around when I need it. There you go. Shake it, shake it some more. Give it some hallelujah.
I knew Iowa was good for something other than meth and corn.
And Leslie Hall, one of my favorite gem sweater divas, who comes from the beautiful state of corn. Mm-hmm. Or is Iowa known for the corn, not the potatoes?
Corn and meth.
And meth.
Right.
Sadly, meth. But you
traditionally,
know,
it's been corn, but I think meth is kind of like...
And all the, you know, everybody like rags on corn. I like corn. I like eating corn, fresh corn on the cob.
We had popcorn last night.
I know, it's fabulous. Not all corn is evil, you know, because we wreck so much.
But everybody, like, you know, people are happy, but other people are kind of cautious because it was the same kind of thing that happened in California with the whole Prop 8 and that resolution. So there, people are really afraid that the same thing might happen in Iowa. But I think, you know, it's right. You celebrate what you have now.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, I guess I've been kind of surprised that there hasn't been more celebration of this. And, you know, I mean, it's a Midwestern state. And I think, you know, from what I've read about it, it doesn't sound like, you know, then if they wanted to repeal it, it would have to be a constitutional amendment. And that would probably take several years for them to get it together. And, you know, hopefully by then people will realize that, you know, there's really no consequences. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what was so really great about the way the Iowa Supreme Court wrote their decision is because one of the things they pointed out is, what's the problem with this? You know, they right. asked, like, why not? Why shouldn't we do gay marriage, mm-hmm. you know, or same-sex marriage? Like, there's no, it doesn't hurt anyone.
There was a wonderful quote, and it was on the front page of page 1Q, and it said something about, like, look, you know, this is one of those rights issues, and rights change over time, and sometimes, you know, the rights that you had 50 years ago are going to change, and this is something that's changing, and this is a Absolutely. Marriage right that has, that's, you know, its time has come.
I guess, so, shout out to Mike Rogers at page1q.com. Mm-hmm.
And I want to remind people, too, I mean, it was like, you know, Iowa gave us, I mean, Obama's from Illinois, but really it was Iowa that really put him on the map as far as in the primaries, because he took Iowa, and people were like, what? And so it was really, it was like, it was that challenge to Hillary Clinton that, you know, gave us him for the presidency.
And we might just be getting health care just around the mm-hmm. corner. I want to do a quick, take a little break and do a little shout out to Peterson Urgent Care at 2300 West Peterson. Do a shout out to Hannah and Silva and Dr. Del Mundo, who took care of Mark's eye
infection.
Your pink eye.
Yeah.
For 50
I'm
bucks.
I'm so gay, I got pink eye.
Because, you know, it got us $50, and then the medicine you got was $70.
Is that how much my visit was? It was only $50?
$50. Uh-huh. And this is what you know, they do great for people who don't have health insurance, mm-hmm. which is a significant number of an American population. Mm-hmm. And is...
Now you can walk right in.
You can just walk right in.
Open
Hannah and Silva hook you up.
Noon to 8.
You know, and I think that's an important thing that we need to bring into this discussion is how is our ability to access medical, psychiatric, psychological health care going to change once we actually have access to it?
Do you have any ideas?
People will go and get mental health care.
Go to your doctor. But it is a situation that I've always argued that we could do a lot to fighting substance abuse and HIV and sexually transmitted diseases if our communities or these disenfranchised groups had access to doctors mm-hmm. and make them more mindful, more aware of things they can do to stay healthy. Mm-hmm. Jim Pickett wants to know, how do you stay healthy, Dr. Brian Mustansky?
I think he wants you to write that on his blog.
I know. Right. Well, what do you want to say? What is like something that simple that you do? And you go, you know, I'm taking good care of myself.
I would.
And you have gorgeous skin, by the way.
Thank you.
You know, for a 60-year-old man, you look great.
Ouch.
Just kidding.
You know, I think the first thing that comes to mind is really like my relationship. Like I feel like my relationship with Jarrett really brings out so much healthiness in me, if that's a okay way to say that, because I think he really balances my, like I have a tendency to probably be a workaholic. Like I could probably work 24 hours a day. And I think he really helps keep me healthy by reminding me like, oh, let's go out for dinner tonight. Let's go.
You're like me.
Live our life, you know.
We're the workhorses and we marry people who are, give us, as my friend Kirthy says, quality of life.
Yes.
But the stress comes when you want to work and your partner who tends to be more of the recreational oriented is that you're
quality
like
of lifer.
The quality of lifer, and you're like, dude, we got to get stuff done, and that kind of tension. I mean, subconsciously, we're attracted to partners that help balance us out.
Absolutely,
but that's also a source of conflict.
You know, I mean, I think we've talked about it. I mean, I think that's something that we sort of discuss and negotiate, and you know, in terms of figuring out like how are we going to structure our time so that we have time to do fun stuff, and I also have time to get my work done, and you know, we come up with. these agreements and, you know, like, oh, I'm only going to work from home 2 evenings a night or, you know, two evenings a week.
Do you make them sign contracts?
I don't, no. We just do verbal contracts.
Mark tried to get me to sign a contract.
I had him sign one once.
Yeah. Does he tend to forget agreements that I made?
I'm not going to say what it was about, but I made him sign it.
I don't even remember what it was about myself.
I don't know if I even still have it.
Well, maybe that's why he's getting things in writing faster.
Yeah, see?
For the divorce settlement. Well, I mean, you know, we were hanging out with our friend Gigi this weekend. We're hanging out with our kids. And it's like something that I wanted to bring up is that as gay and lesbian people, transgendered, bisexual people, we feel anxious about forming friendships and support for people with children. And we sometimes don't complete that intergenerational circle by bringing ourselves into the lives of our friends, family, or bringing children into our own lives.
Yeah.
You know, and I think like it's really healthy right now that Madonna is bringing so much attention to adoption. And you know, even though she's been told no by the country of Malawi, a lot of these gay men who idolize and look up to Madonna are going to say, you know, maybe I need to bring a child into my life. Because a lot of these guys, these gay guys have money up the wazoo. They got spare time, and I think you would do yourself a world of favor if you had the resources to adopt a kid instead of going to that circuit party.
Well, I think, listen, if you're going to a circuit party and you're thinking, well, I'm going to change my circuit party life for adopt a baby, I think adopt a child, you're going to want that.
There might be some intermediate steps. Yeah,
you're going to have something pulling
at you. Maybe get a dog first.
Well, get a dog first. You know, it's like, here.
Well, if you're going to get a dog, you might as well get a child, because at least a child after 12 years, it's going to take care of itself.
Yeah, but you can't put a child in a cage.
listen to this. Okay, so 14% of the adults in Malawi are infected with the HIV virus.
14%?
14%. Mm-hmm. Millions of people are there's millions of orphans in Malawi, and Madonna helps to personally fund and organize a charity that supports those orphans.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the government, the lawyer, the judge said that the 50-year-old Madonna could not take the girl.
Her child, the little girl.
Her name was Chifundo Mercy James out of the country of Malawi because she had not been residing there. But I'm like, you know what? They allowed her to do it with David.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't they allow this? If I was that little kid, I'd be suing the government. I'd be like, you robbed me out of Prada shoes and a rich, crazy mommy. You know? Instead, I have to, like, be an orphan now. I mean, that's just fucked up.
It is kind of fucked up.
It makes me mad.
It is. Well, they want... The thing is, like, there's so many kids there that need help and stuff like that. And is adoption really the best option? Or is it better to, you know, fund these programs?
Well, for Mercy, it certainly is.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be pissed off. It's like, oh yeah, Bill Gates was considering adopting you, but the hospital said no.
I'd be like, I'll meet you in Nigeria.
Yeah, if I was that kid, I'd be like, give Madonna my phone number, be like, just meet me at the airport. I'll be wearing a mustache. You know, how old was this kid?
I think she's 4 or something like that.
You know, 4-year-olds can be extremely resourceful.
Mm-hmm.
If I was that 4-year-old, I'd be like, you know, just meet me at the gates.
Well, really? I wonder too if maybe they'll consider like changing the laws, because they have they have a residency law that you have to be a resident for 18 months to adopt a baby. And you know, no European, no American, no Canadian or Australian, or somebody from a wealthy, affluent country is going to reside there for 18 months to adopt a child.
But there's a sense of nationalism, and there's also a sense of pride, is that our country cannot take care of its own.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And so that might be getting into that, you know? And I think, you know what? It's like...
And with these third world country or developing countries, you know, there's a lot of graft involved. People want to be paid off, and there's things...
There's shadiness.
A lot of nature like
that. There's microaggressions against people.
Against poor Madonna.
And, you know, and Madge needs to get her... You know, if Madge wants a rainbow coalition of a family, let her... Please have it. You know, I want her to inspire people of means to adopt children she's not being an octo mommy, right? You know, she's not impregnating her with like 100 different kinds of, well, she did that with the first daughter, but that's a whole different story. But you know, she's like wanting to adopt kids. And I think that's actually a healthy, constructive thing. And for, you know, I know I give Madonna little microaggressions on the show, but I want to, you know, really say that I'm 110% behind her adopting these kids.
Well, pop stars don't have it easy. Certainly Hideki Kaji from Japan I guess he's a big pop star there.
Yeah.
He was dressed.
He's known for his song, Piña Colada. I don't know what his song
is. I don't know what he's known for, but he was actually dressed up as a pineapple, and he was shooting a music video in Sweden when he was attacked and people robbed his camera equipment, which is worth around, $3,000 or $3,500.
So he was, the crew went for a coffee break, and they left Hideki dressed up as a pineapple. I guess because, putting him in his pineapple costume too much.
In Sweden,
in the middle of nowhere, I guess. And so they left this famous person dressed up as a pineapple, surrounded by $3,500 worth of expensive camera equipment, probably high definition. And then these thugs came up over there and be like, stop beating yourself, stop robbing yourself.
But on the other hand, some pop stars have it really nice. Like Lady Gaga recently was quoted saying that she had signed somebody a fan's penis. She goes, I feel embarrassed saying this, but the strangest thing I have ever autographed was a man's penis. I was doing a meet and greet backstage in Canada. I had enough room to write Lady Gaga. I was laughing so hard I could barely breathe. Maybe it was still there. Who knows? It was a permanent marker, too.
It was a Sharpie. Yeah. Sharpie's rub-off.
I'll sign Feast of Fun on somebody's penis.
Is that one line right across Feast of Fun? Or that's your two lines?
I can make it fit. Real big, so I'll make it fit no matter what size penis you have. I'm not a size queen.
You know, let me just say...
You might need a fine
It works. Sharpie. It fits. That's all I'm going to say.
It'll fit.
The words fit. You know, I always make sure to put the .com on it.
If I have to abbreviate it as FOF, I will.
Because it pisses me off when people refer to us as Feast of Fun or Feast of Fools in the old thing without putting the URL, the .com. Because then people go, who, what is that?
Feastoffun.com.
But when you hear the .com, then you go, oh, it's an internet thing. Right. You know?
So it must be fabulous.
So if you were going to sign a penis, you'd make sure to put the .com on there.
Yeah. Absolutely. Right on the head. Or along the balls.
And so, you know, I think that's a healthy thing, that the fact that gay marriage is now legal in Iowa, because, you know, straight people certainly don't always get along. They might want to try some of that gay marriage for themselves. There's a German woman. She just divorced her husband for cleaning the house too much. He was so crazy that there was a wall in the house and it got smudged. And he knocked down the wall and rebuilt it as opposed to painting over it or cleaning it. So he's like kind of crazy cleaning. You know, the fact that he wants to do construction as opposed to just...
Who cleans in your house, Brian? You or your husband?
We both do.
You do both do?
Yeah. He does more, though.
He does more?
He's better at it.
He's better at it? Okay.
So, Brian, we're wrapping up here. What is the long-term consequences for gay and lesbian people? How do we know we're actually healing ourselves?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things to think about are, like, what are the validations that we have in our life, too? And I think that's one of the directions this needs to go in, is thinking, yeah, we can think about the negative things that happen to us and the comments that people make, but what are the positive experiences that we have in our life? And maybe some that we might be more likely to have because of being gay, lesbian, or bisexual.
So I think understanding those.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think they both are important. And like thinking about, you know, when I was thinking a lot about these microaggression kind of things, you know, I was sitting on a plane and I happened to be sitting next to an older married couple that one of the things they were telling me about is like how much they loved their son and his boyfriend and just sort of spontaneously started telling me that. And it was very validating for me to hear them. And it made me comfortable telling them about me and my partner. And I think we need to think about those kinds of experiences, too, that can be really validating.
So micro praisings.
Yeah, we just need to come up with a good word for it. Micro celebration.
I micro celebrate Brian Mustansky.
I'm going to macro celebrate.
Thank you. What does that mean?
Macro is the big picture.
He's
big.
Married, Mark, and so are you. Well, technically.
We can still have fun.
Really?
You know? Yeah, we don't have to take our clothes off to have a good time. We can dance and party all night.
Stop quoting 80s song lyrics to me.
I want to remind people that we can't do this show without your help, so please visit our website, feastoffun.com, make a donation, buy a t-shirt.
And our guest today has been Dr. Brian Mustansky. He's a professor of psychiatry at the University of Illinois in Chicago. You actually have students.
Mm-hmm.
Really? So the students are listening to this right now. How can they hack the system to get an A in your class? I know how.
You know what?
I'll give them some advice.
Don't tell anyone how to do that.
Go meet with your teacher, because teachers statistically give better grades to people they know than people they don't know, and you learn more.
when you have an interpersonal relationship with your teachers.
Unless you show up in their office and ask, like, just for the sake of being there. You have to have a reasonable thing
like,
to talk
don't
about.
Don't waste my time. Yeah.
Well, you want to talk about things, right? You have office hours. Make use of them. That's what my mother, she's always like,
I have office hours.
And she's just chatting away with people. You know, she's a Spanish teacher. So
she likes to yak.
So you can read Dr. Brian Mustanzi's fabulous blog on Psychology Today through our, we'll put up a link because it's, you've got to get a short URL.
And you have a fan page for your
on
work.
Facebook, yeah. On Facebook, yes. So you can look for Sexual Continuum is the name of the blog. It's they have a fan page on Facebook.
So we'll put up a link to it on today's show. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Gillian.
And the music featured on today's show is the music of Eric Lindell, If Love Can't Find a Way, from his album Gulf Coast Highway. It's available on our website, feastoffun.com. One day I'll get it right. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Yeah, good love.